dental assistant, until the circle took up almost half the page.
Go in with the attitude they're lucky to get you.
Okay.
In a non-threatening way, of course.
Okay.
And be friendly, but don't talk too much.
David pointed the remote control, and the television switched off. The end of the living room was dark.
Poor old sweetie pie, said David, standing up and walking to her.
He put his arm around her neck and squeezed playfully.
We should just take you out to the pasture and shoot you, poor old thing.
David always fell asleep right afterward, but a lot of nights Rebecca lay awake. That night she got up and walked into the kitchen. There was a bar across the street that you could see from the window, a noisy place. You could hear everything that happened in the parking lot. But Rebecca liked having the bar there. On nights when she couldn't sleep, she liked knowing there were other people awake. She stood there thinking of the man in the story, the ordinary, balding man sitting alone in his office at lunchtime. And she thought of her father's voice, how she had heard it in her head. She remembered how, one time, he had said to her years ago, there are some men in the world that when they lie down beside a woman, they are no different from dogs. She remembered how once, a few years after her mother left, Rebecca announced she was going to go live with her. You can't, her father said, without looking up from his reading. She gave you up. I've gone to court. I have sole custody. For a long time, Rebecca had thought it was spelled S-O-U-L. She watched a police car pull into the parking lot. Two policemen got out, and the flashing lights stayed on, the edge of them zinging blue through the window, across the sink and the Maalox spoon. There had probably been a fight. A lot of nights there were fights in the bar. Rebecca, standing at the window, felt a tiny smile inside her getting larger. How delicious it would be! That one moment of perfect joy, propped up and righteous with booze, to let that first punch fly.
Feel this, said David, flexing his muscle. Really?
Rebecca leaned over her cereal bowl and touched his arm. It was like touching frozen earth.
That's amazing, she said. That really is.
David stood and looked at himself in the toaster. He flexed both arms together, like a boxer showing off before a crowd. Then he turned side to and looked at himself that way. He nodded.
Okay, he said. Not bad.
The only mirror Rebecca's father had in their house was the one that hung over the bathroom sink. If she wasn't brushing her teeth or washing her face, she wasn't supposed to be near that mirror. Vanity was a sin.
Your mother ran away from one cult just to join another, her Aunt Catherine had said. For God's sake, no Congregationalist lives like this.
Except Rebecca did. She wished her aunt would stop it, just go away and stop saying those things.
Do you want to come live with us?
Her aunt asked her once, and Rebecca shook her head. She didn't want to mention the sole custody. Besides, her Aunt Catherine made her anxious, the same way her math teacher, Mrs. Kittredge, did. Mrs. Kittredge would look at her hard sometimes when the class was supposed to be working. Once she had said to Rebecca in the hallway,
If you ever want to talk to me about anything, you can.
Rebecca hadn't answered, had just moved past her with her books.
All right, I'm out of here,
David said, zipping his workout bag closed.
You got the number for the dental assistant?
Yes, Rebecca said.
Good luck, Bickabeck, said David.
He went to the refrigerator and drank from the orange juice carton. Then he picked up the keys and kissed her goodbye.
Remember, he said, be confident and don't talk too much.
Right, got it,
Rebecca said, nodding. Goodbye. She sat at the table with the dirty cereal bowls in front of her and thought about her urge to talk. It had come over her soon after her father died, and it had not gone away. It was a physical thing, really. She wanted to give it up the way people gave up smoking. Her father had a rule, no talking at the table. It was a strange rule when you thought about it, because there had been only the two of them sitting in the little dining room of the rectory each night. It could be that her father was tired at the end of his day, after visiting the sick and the dying. It was a small town, but there was usually someone sick and quite frequently someone dying, and he wanted it quiet so that he could rest. At any rate, they had sat there night after night, the only sounds being silverware touching a plate or a water glass being put back on the table, and the soft, too intimate sounds of their chewing. Sometimes Rebecca would look up and see how her father had a piece of food caught on his chin, and she wouldn't be able to swallow. She'd feel such a sudden love for him. But other times, especially as she got older, she was glad to see all the butter he used. It was his love for butter she was counting on, hoping that would do him in. She stood now and washed out the cereal bowls. Then she wiped the counter and straightened the chairs. A pinprick of heat started up in her stomach, so she got the Maalox bottle and the Maalox spoon, and as she was shaking the bottle, she got an image of David leaning toward her, reminding her not to talk too much, and it came to her then that of course the large would be too big.
"No problem," the woman said. "I'll just check and see if the order's gone out."
Even scraping with her fingernail, there was a layer of dried Maalox that wouldn't come off the spoon. Rebecca put the spoon back onto the counter. "I thought I probably wouldn't get the same person again," she said. "Wow, or maybe you're just a small outfit." There was no answer. "I mean, being a small outfit's just fine," said Rebecca, ripping two pages of the story out of the magazine. There was still no answer, and finally Rebecca understood she'd been put on hold. She watched the pages go up in flames, the section where the wife just left. The flame was higher than the sink. A thrill of anxiety rose in Rebecca. She waited, her hands on the faucet, but the flame dipped down.
"Never mind," the woman said back on the phone. "The order's already gone out. Just send it back if it's too big, and we'll send out a medium. Tell me, how's your headache today?"
"You remember?" Rebecca said.
"Well, of course I remember," the woman said.
"No headache today," Rebecca said, "but I have a problem. I have to get a job."
"You don't have a job?"
the woman asked with her lovely southern voice. "No, I have to get one."
"Well, sure," the woman said. "A job is real important. What kind of job are you looking for?"
"Something low stress," Rebecca said. "It's not that I'm lazy or anything," she said. And then she said, "Well, maybe I am. Maybe that's true."
"Don't say that,"
the woman said.
"I'm sure that's not true."
She was a wonderful woman. Rebecca thought about the man in the story. He should meet this woman.
"Thank you," Rebecca said. "That's really nice."
"Now you send it back if it's too big. It's no problem,"
the woman assured her.
"No problem at all."
The death of Rebecca's father was not the saddest thing, nor was the absence of her mother. The saddest thing was when she fell in love with Jace Burke at the university and he broke up with her. Jace was a piano player, and one time when her father went to a conference, she brought Jace back to Crosby for the night. Jace looked around the rectory and said,
"Baby, this is one strange place."
He looked at her with a tenderness that was like a sweet erasure of all the darkness in her past. Later, they went to the warehouse bar and grill, where the kind of crazy Angela O'Meara still played the piano in the bar.
"Oh, man, she's great," Jace said.
"My father always lets her come to the church to play whenever she feels like it. She doesn't have a piano," Rebecca explained. "She never did."
"She's great," Jace repeated softly,
and Rebecca felt a delicious warmth toward her father then,
as though her father had seen some greatness in poor half-soused Angie, too, that Rebecca had never known. When they left, Jay slipped a $20 bill into Angela's tip jar. Angela made a kiss in their direction and played Hello, Young Lovers as they left the bar. When Jace left the university, he played in bars all over Boston. Sometimes the bars were fancy places with thick carpets and leather chairs, and sometimes there'd be a poster out front with Jace's picture on it. But a lot of times his luck was bad, and he'd have to play the electric organ in strip joints just to earn some money. Every weekend, Rebecca took a Greyhound bus and stayed with him in his dirty apartment, where there were cockroaches in the silverware drawer. On Sunday evenings, when she got back, she'd call her father and tell him how hard she was studying. Later on, when she was living with David, she'd sometimes let herself remember those weekends with Jace, the dirty sheets against her skin, the way Jace's metal chairs felt, sitting on them naked while they ate English muffins by the open window, grime all around the window casing. She'd remember standing at the dirty sink in the bathroom, naked, Jace standing behind her, naked too, seeing themselves in the mirror. There was no voice of her father's in her head, no thoughts of men behaving like dogs. All of it was easy as pie. One night in the bathtub, Jace told her about a blonde woman he'd met. Rebecca sat with the face cloth in her hand, staring at the cracked caulking around the edge of the tub, at the dirt wedged into the cracks. "These things happen," is what Jace said. Later that week, her father called. Even now, Rebecca didn't understand exactly what had been wrong with her father's heart. He hadn't said exactly, only that there was nothing the doctors could do. "But they can do all sorts of things, Daddy," she said. "I mean, I hear about all kinds of heart procedures and stuff."
"Not my heart,"
he answered, and there was fear in his voice. The fear made Rebecca wonder if perhaps her father hadn't believed all those things he'd preached for years. But even when she heard the fear in his voice and felt the fear herself, she knew what she felt most badly about was Jace and the blonde.
"Tell me," David said, "what's a face cloth doing in the freezer?"
"I didn't get the job," Rebecca said.
"No?"
David closed the freezer door.
"I'm kind of surprised. I thought you would. What do they want, a PhD?
He tore the end off a loaf of bread that was on the counter and stuck it into a jar of spaghetti sauce.
"Poor Bickerbeck," he said, and shook his head.
"Maybe it's because I talked about the barium enema I had," Rebecca said with a shrug. She turned the heat down so the spaghetti wouldn't boil over. "I talked a lot," she admitted. "I probably talked too much." David sat down at the table and looked at her.
"See, that might not be a good idea. See, Bicca, maybe nobody ever told you this, but people don't really want to hear about other people's barium enemas."
Rebecca took the face cloth out of the freezer. She folded it into a strip and sat down across from David, holding the face cloth over her eyes. "If a person's had one," she said, "I don't think they would mind." David didn't answer. "Evidently, the dentist never had one," Rebecca added.
"Man," said David, "where in the world did you come from? Can I just ask how the subject came up? Wouldn't it make more sense to be talking about teeth?"
"We'd already talked about teeth by then," Rebecca pressed on the face cloth. "I was telling him why I wanted the job, how important it is for all these helpers dressed in white to be nice to scared people."
"Okay, okay," David said.
Rebecca peeled back the face cloth and looked at him with one eye.
"Tomorrow you'll get a job," he said.
And she did. She got a job in Augusta, typing traffic reports for a fat man who scowled and never said please. The man was the head of an agency that studied the flow of traffic in and around different cities in the state, so the cities would know where to build ramps and put up lights.
Rebecca hadn't thought of anyone doing that before, studying traffic, and it was interesting the first morning. But by afternoon, it was not so interesting anymore, and after a few weeks, she knew she would probably quit. One afternoon, as she was typing, her hand began to shake. When she held up her other hand, it was shaking too. She felt the way she had on the Greyhound bus that weekend Jace had told her about the blonde, when she kept thinking, "This can't be my life." And then she thought that most of her life she had been thinking, "This can't be my life." In the lobby near the mailboxes was a brown, padded envelope addressed to Rebecca. The shirt had made its way from Kentucky to Maine. Rebecca carried it upstairs to the apartment and pulled the tab across the top of the envelope while pieces of gray stuffing sprayed across the table. The woman was right. It was a beautiful shirt. Rebecca spread it out over the couch, arranging the full sleeves over the cushions, and then stepped back to look. This was not a shirt David would wear. Never in the world would David wear this shirt. This was a shirt for Jace.
"It happens,"
the woman said cheerfully.
"Just send it on back."
"All right," Rebecca said.
"You sound discouraged,"
the woman said.
"But you'll get your money back, honey. It'll take a few weeks, but you'll get it back."
"All right," Rebecca said again.
"No problem, honey. It's no problem at all."
The next day, Rebecca looked around the doctor's office for something to steal. Other than magazines, there wasn't much. It was like they'd planned it that way. Even the coat hangers were the kind that couldn't come off the rack. But there was a small glass vase on the windowsill, plain and ordinary, with the pale remnants of a brown stain around the bottom.
"The doctor will see you now," said the nurse.
Rebecca followed her down the hallway into the examining room. She rolled up her sleeve for the blood pressure check.
"How's the stomach feel?"
the nurse asked and glanced at the chart.
"Good," Rebecca said. "Well, not good. The Maalox doesn't really work."
The nurse unpeeled the Velcro strip from Rebecca's arm.
"Tell the doctor," she said.
But the doctor, Rebecca could see right away, was irritated with her. He folded his arms across his white-coated chest and pressed his lips together, gazing at her without blinking.
"It still hurts," Rebecca said.
And what?"
She had been planning on telling him how her hands were shaking, how she felt that something was deeply wrong.
"And I just wondered why it still hurt."
She looked down at her feet.
"Rebecca, we've run upper and lower GIs on you, done the blood work, and what you have to accept is that you're fine. You have a sensitive stomach. A lot of people do."
Back in the waiting room, Rebecca put her coat on, standing near the window and gazing out, as if she were interested in the parking lot below. For a moment, her head didn't ache, her stomach didn't ache. There was nothing in her except a thrill as clean as fresh water, like she was the pure flame her lighter became. Nearby, a man read a magazine, a woman filed her nails. Rebecca put the vase into her knapsack and left. That night, they sat on the floor watching an old movie on television. Anyone looking through the window would have seen Rebecca sitting, leaning against the couch, David next to her, holding a bottle of seltzer water, as ordinary looking as a couple could be.
"I never shoplifted when I was a kid," Rebecca said.
"I did," said David, still watching the movie. "I stole a watch from the drugstore I worked in. I stole a lot of things."
"I never did it because I was scared I'd get caught," Rebecca said. "Not because it was wrong. I mean, I knew it was wrong, but that's not why I didn't do it."
"I even stole a present for my mother's birthday," David said, and he chuckled. "Some kind of pin."
"Most kids probably do it at some point," Rebecca said, "I guess. I don't know. When I was little, I never went over to other kids' houses, and they never came to mine."
David didn't say anything.
My father said it didn't look good, Rebecca explained, for a minister's kids to show favorites in a small town like that.
David kept looking at the television.
That stinks, he said. Watch this. I love this part. The guy's going to get chopped up by that boat propeller.
She looked out the window at the dark.
Then I got to 9th grade, she said, and my father decided the church shouldn't be spending money on a housekeeper for us anymore. So after that, I cooked. I used to cook special meals for him practically soaked in butter.
God, she said. David hooted.
There he goes! Gross!
I bet legally that makes me some kind of criminal.
What's that, honey pie?
David said, but Rebecca didn't say it again. David patted her foot.
We'll bring our kids up differently. Don't you worry.
Rebecca still didn't say anything.
This is a great movie,
David said, settling back against her legs.
This is just great. In a minute, they cut off that cat's head. This is a great movie,
David said, settling back against her legs.
This is just great. In a minute, they cut off that cat's head.
Something was going on at the bar. Three police cars pulled into the parking lot, and the lights were left flashing while the police went inside. Rebecca waited by the kitchen window, the lights zinging across her arm, across the kitchen floor. Two of the policemen came out of the bar, holding a man between them with his hands behind his back. They stood the man against one of the cars, and then one of the policemen said to him,
"You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can be used against you in a court of law."
The policeman's voice was not kind or unkind, just steady and clear.
"You have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford an attorney, you have the right to have an attorney appointed to you."
It was like poetry, the way the Bible was like poetry if you heard it read the right way. The other policeman came out of the bar, and pretty soon they put the man in the back seat, and then all three cars drove away. The kitchen seemed dark without their flashing lights. She could make out the Maalox spoon by the corner of the sink, a few glinting white specks on it. For a long time, Rebecca sat at the kitchen table in the dark. She pictured the doctor's office, the streets the bus took to get there. In Maisie Mills, no buses ran at night. She thought it might take her almost half an hour to walk. "If you can't figure out something," Jace had once told her, "don't watch what you think, watch what you do." She watched herself take the barbecue starter stuff from beneath the sink, put it into her knapsack. She watched herself quietly slip from her underwear drawer the old postcards from her mother. In the kitchen, she ripped them in half, and when she did, a tiny sound came from her. She put them into the knapsack. Then she put in the shirt she'd bought for David, and also the rest of the magazine where the ad had come from. She put two cigarette lighters into her coat pocket. Moving carefully down the hall stairway, the words repeated in her head.
"You have the right to remain silent. You have the right. You have the right. You have the right."
It would be worth the arrest if they put it like that. River. The day before, she almost backed into him in the parking lot of the library, and though he didn't shout, he raised an arm as though to ward off the coming car, or perhaps just out of surprise. In either case, Olive had stepped on the brake in time, and Jack Kennison did not look at her, just kept walking to his own car, a small, shiny red one parked a few feet away.
"Old horror," Olive thought.
He was a tall man with a big belly, slouching shoulders, and, in her mind, a kind of arrogant furtiveness in the way he held his head thrust forward and didn't look at people. He had gone to Harvard, had lived in New Jersey, whether teaching at Princeton or somewhere else, Olive didn't know, but a number of years ago,
He had retired with his wife to a house they'd built on the edge of a small field here in Crosby, Maine. At the time, Olive had said to her husband,
"Stupid to pour all that money into a place not even on the water."
And Henry had agreed. The reason she knew Jack Kennison had gone to Harvard was because the waitress at the marina told Olive that he let everyone know.
"How obnoxious,"
Henry had said with real disgust. They had never had a conversation with the Kennisons, had only passed them sometimes in town, or had seen them at the marina for breakfast. Henry always said hello, and Mrs. Kennison said hello back. She was a small woman with a quick smile.
"I expect she's spent her life making up for his boorishness," said Olive,
and Henry nodded. Henry did not always warm up to summer people or retirees, those who came up the coast to live out their last days in a setting of slanting light. They were apt to have money, and often a grating sense of entitlement. For example, one man felt entitled to write an article in the local paper poking fun at the natives, saying they were cold and aloof. And there was the woman who'd been overheard at Moody's store asking her husband,
"Why is everyone in this state fat, and why do they all look retarded?"
She was, according to whoever had told the story, a Jew from New York, and so there was that. Even now, there were people who'd have preferred a Muslim family to move in rather than be insulted by a Jew from New York. Jack Kennison was neither, but he was not a native, and he had an arrogant look. When the waitress at the marina reported that the Kennisons had a daughter who was gay, living in Oregon, and that it was Mr. Kennison who wouldn't accept it, Henry said,
"Oh, that's wrong. You need to accept your children either way."
Henry had never been tested, of course. Christopher was not gay. Henry had lived long enough to see his son divorced, but a massive stroke soon after, and Olive would never be convinced the divorce hadn't done it, had kept Henry paralyzed and unknowing when Christopher married again. Henry died in the nursing home before the baby was born. 1.5 years later, this still squeezed Olive so hard she felt like a package of vacuum-packed coffee as she clutched the steering wheel, leaning forward in the dawn's light to peer through the windshield. She had left the house while it was still dark, she often did, and it would grow light on the winding tree-lined road into town, a 20-minute drive. Every morning was the same, the long drive, the stop at Dunkin' Donuts, where the Filipino waitress knew she liked extra milk in her coffee, and Olive would take the newspaper and some donut holes, she'd ask for 3, but the girl would always toss in extra, and go back into the car to read the paper, feeding a few donut holes to the dog in the back seat. By 6 o'clock, she felt it was safe enough to walk by the river, though she'd never heard of any trouble on the asphalt path. At 6, it was mostly the old folks, and you could walk a good mile before seeing anyone. Olive parked in the gravelly parking lot, took her walking shoes out of the trunk, tied them on, and took off. It was the best and only bearable part of the day. 3 miles in one direction, 3 miles back. Her one concern was that such daily exercise might make her live longer.
"Let it be quick," she thought now, meaning her death,
a thought she had several times a day. She squinted. A body was slumped on the path not far from the first mile's stone bench. Olive stopped walking. It was an old man, she could see that much as she walked tentatively closer, a balding head, a big belly. God in heaven! She walked with faster steps. Jack Kennison lay on his side, his knees bent, almost like he'd decided to take a nap. She leaned down and saw his eyes were open. His eyes were very blue.
"Are you dead?"
she asked loudly. His eyes moved, looked into hers.
"Apparently not," he said.
She looked at his chest, his big stomach bulging out beneath his L.L. Bean jacket. Then she looked in both directions, up and down the path. No one was in sight.
"Have you been stabbed or shot?"
She leaned closer to him.
"No," he said. Then he added, "Not that I remember." "Can you move?" "I don't know. I haven't tried."
His big stomach was moving, though, slowly up and down.
"Well, try."
She touched her sneaker to his black walking shoe.
"Try to move this leg."
The leg moved.
"Good," said Olive. "Try an arm."
Slowly, the man's arm moved onto his stomach.
"I don't have one of those cell phone things," Olive said. "My son keeps saying he'll buy me one, but he hasn't. I'm going back to the car and drive to call someone."
"Don't,"
said Jack Kennison. "Don't leave me alone."
Olive stood, uncertain. It was a mile away, her car. She looked at him, lying there, his blue eyes watching hers.
"What happened?"
she asked.
"I don't know." "Then you ought to get a doctor."
"Okay."
"I'm Olive Kittredge, by the way. Don't believe we've ever formally met. If you can't get up, I think I should go find you a doctor. I hate them myself, but you can't just lie there," she said. "You might die."
"I don't care,"
he said. A small smile seemed to come to his eyes.
"What?"
Olive asked loudly, bending way down toward him.
"I don't care if I die,"
the man said.
"Just don't leave me here alone."
Olive sat down on the bench nearby. The river was calm, barely seemed to be moving. She bent toward him again.
"Are you cold?" she asked.
"Not really."
"It's nippy out."
Now that she had stopped walking, she felt a chill herself.
"Do you hurt?"
"No."
"Is it your heart, do you think?"
"I don't know."
He began to stir. Olive stood and put a hand beneath his arm, though he was much too heavy for her to do any good. Still, after a great deal of struggling, he managed to get himself up and settled on the bench.
"All right," said Olive, sitting down beside him. "This is better. Now we wait for someone to come along with a phone."
She added suddenly,
"I don't care if I die either. I'd like to, in fact, long as it's quick."
He turned his balding head toward her, studied her tiredly with his blue eyes.
"I don't want to die alone," he said.
"Hell, we're always alone. Born alone, die alone. What difference does it make? Long as you don't shrivel for years in a nursing home like my poor husband did. That's my fear."
She pulled at her sweater, clutched it closed with a fist. She turned to look at him carefully.
"Your color seems all right. You don't have any idea what happened?"
Jack Kennison stared out at the river.
"I was walking. I saw the bench and felt tired. I don't sleep well, so I sat down and started to feel dizzy. I put my head between my legs, and the next thing I knew, I was lying on the ground with some woman squawking at me, 'Are you dead?'"
Olive's face became warm.
"You seem less dead every minute," she said. "Do you think you can walk?"
"In a moment, I'll try. I'd like to sit here a moment."
Olive glanced at him quickly. He was crying. She looked away, and from the corner of her eye, she saw him reach into his pocket, heard him blow his nose, a real honk.
"My wife died in December,"
he said. Olive watched the river.
"Then you're in hell," she said.
"Then I'm in hell."
In the doctor's waiting room, she sat reading a magazine. After an hour, the nurse came out and said,
"Mr. Kennison's worried about you waiting so long."
"Well, tell him to stop it. I'm perfectly comfortable."
And she was. In fact, it had been a long time since she'd been this comfortable. She wouldn't have minded if it took all day. It was a news magazine she was reading, something she hadn't done for quite a while. She turned one page quickly because she couldn't stand to look at the president's face. His close-set eyes, the jut of his chin, the sight offended her viscerally. She had lived through a lot of things with this country, but she had never lived through the mess they were in now. Here was a man who looked retarded, Olive thought, remembering the remark made by the woman in Moody's store. You could see it in his stupid little eyes, and the country had voted him in. A born-again Christian with a cocaine addiction. So they deserved to go to hell, and would. It was only her son Christopher she worried about, and his baby boy. She wasn't sure there would be a world left for them. Olive set the magazine aside and leaned back comfortably. The outer door opened, and Jane Holton walked in, took a seat in the waiting area not far from Olive.
"Say, that's a pretty skirt you're wearing," said Olive.
Although she had never cared for Jane Holton one way or another, Jane being a kind of timorous thing.
"Do you know, I got this on sale at a store that was closing in Augusta."
Jane smoothed her hand down over the green tweed.
"Oh, wonderful," said Olive. "Every woman loves a bargain."
She nodded appreciatively.
"Very good."
She drove Jack Kennison back to the parking lot by the river so he could get his car, and then she followed him home. In the driveway of his house on the edge of the field, he said,
"Would you like to come in and have some lunch? I might find an egg or a can of baked beans."
"No," said Olive. "I think you should rest. You've had enough excitement for one day."
The doctor had taken a whole bunch of tests, and so far nothing had been found to be wrong with him. Stress fatigue is what the doctor, for the moment, had diagnosed.
"And the dog's been cooped up in the car all morning," Olive added.
"All right, then," Jack said.
He raised a hand.
"Thanks very much."
Driving home, Olive felt bereft. The dog whined, and she told him to stop it, and he lay down on the back seat as though exhausted from the morning himself. She telephoned her friend Bunny and told her the story of finding Jack Kennison on the path by the river.
"Oh, the poor man," said Bunny,
whose husband was still alive, a husband who had driven her nuts for most of her married life, arguing about how to raise their daughter, wearing a baseball hat when he sat down to lunch. All this had driven Bunny batty. But now it was as though she'd won a lottery, because he was still alive, and Olive thought Bunny could see what it was like, her friends losing their husbands and drowning in the emptiness. In fact, Bunny, Olive sometimes thought, didn't really want to be around Olive too much, as though Olive's widowhood was like a contagious disease. She talked to Olive on the phone, though.
"How lucky you came by and found him," Bunny said. "Imagine lying there."
"Somebody else would have ambled along," Olive added. "I might just give him a call later to make sure he's all right."
"Oh, do," said Bunny.
At 5 o'clock, Olive looked up his number in the phone book. She started to dial, then stopped. At 7 o'clock, she called.
"You all right?" she asked, not introducing herself.
"Hi, Olive," he said. "I seem to be. Thanks."
"Did you call your daughter?" Olive asked.
No,
he said with what Olive thought was a small sound of puzzlement.
"She might want to know you weren't feeling well."
"I don't see any reason to bother her," he said.
"All right, then."
Olive looked around the kitchen, its emptiness and silence.
"Goodbye."
She went into the next room and lay down, holding her transistor radio to her ear. A week passed. Olive was aware on her early morning walks by the river that the time spent in the waiting room while Jack Kennison saw the doctor had, for one brief moment, put her back into life. And now she was out of life again. It was a conundrum. In the time since Henry had died, she had tried many things. She had become a docent at the art museum in Portland, but after a few months, she found she could hardly endure the 4 hours required for her to be in one place. She had volunteered at the hospital, but she could not bear wearing the pink coat and arranging dead flowers while the nurses brushed past her. She had volunteered to speak English to young foreigners at the college who needed simple practice with the language. That had been the best, but it was not enough.
Back and forth she went each morning by the river, spring arriving once again. Foolish, foolish spring, breaking open its tiny buds. And what she couldn't stand was how, for many years really, she had been made happy by such a thing. She had not thought she would ever become immune to the beauty of the physical world, but there you were. The river sparkled with the sun that rose, enough that she needed her sunglasses. Around the little bend in the path, there was the stone bench. Jack Kennison sat on it, watching her approach.
"Hello," said Olive. "Trying again." "All the tests came back," said Jack.
He shrugged.
"Nothing wrong with me. So I thought I'd get back on the horse, as they say. Yes, I'm trying again."
"Admirable. Are you coming or going?"
The idea of walking 2 miles with him and then 3 miles back to the car unnerved her.
Going back.
She hadn't noticed his red, shiny car in the parking lot when she'd started out.
"Did you drive here?" she asked.
"Yes, of course. I've not yet learned to fly."
He was not wearing dark glasses, and she saw how his eyes searched for hers. She did not take her sunglasses off.
"That was a joke," he said.
"I understand that," she responded. "Fly away, fly away, fly away home."
With his open palm, he touched the stone slab he sat on.
"You don't rest?"
"Nope. I just keep on going."
He nodded.
"All right, then. Enjoy your walk."
She started to move past him and turned.
"Do you feel all right? Did you sit down because you got tired?" "I sat down because I felt like it."
She waved a hand above her head and kept going. She noticed nothing on the rest of the walk, not the sun, not the river, not the asphalt path, not any opening buds. She walked and thought of Jack Kennison without the wife, who'd been the friendly one. He'd said he was in hell, and of course he would be. When she got back to the house, she telephoned him.
"Would you like to go to lunch one day?"
"I'd like to go to dinner," he said. "It would give me something to look forward to. If I go to lunch, then I still have the rest of the day."
"All right."
She didn't tell him she went to bed with the sun, that to have an actual dinner in a restaurant would be for her like staying up way past midnight.
"Oh, that's lovely," said Bunny. "Olive, you've got a date."
"Why would you say something so foolish?" Olive asked, really annoyed. "We're 2 lonely people having supper."
"Exactly," said Bunny. "That's a date."
Funny how much that irritated Olive, and she didn't have Bunny to tell it to, since Bunny was the one who'd said it. She called her son, who lived in New York. She asked how the baby was.
"He's great,"
Christopher said.
"He's walking."
"You didn't tell me he was walking."
"Yep, he's walking."
Immediately a sweat broke out on her. She felt it on her face, beneath her arms. It was almost like being told Henry had died, how the nursing home hadn't called her till morning, and now a little relative of hers and Henry's, down there in the foreign land of New York City, was walking through the dark living room of a big old brownstone. She doubted she would be asked to visit, as the last visit had not gone well, to put it mildly.
"Chris, maybe you can come up here this summer for a bit."
"Maybe. We'll see. Got our hands full, but sure, we'd like to. We'll see."
"How long has he been walking?"
"Since last week. Held onto the couch, smiled, then took right off. 3 full steps before he fell down."
You would think a child had never walked before any place on the earth to hear Christopher's voice.
"How are you, Mom?"
His happiness had made him nicer.
"You know, the same. Do you remember Jack Kennison?"
"No."
"Oh, he's a big flub-dub whose wife died in December. Sad. We're having supper next week, and Bunny called it a date. What a stupid thing to say. Honestly, that irritated me."
"Have dinner with him. Consider it volunteer work or something."
Yes, Olive said. You're exactly right.
The evenings were long this time of year, and Jack suggested they meet at the Painted Rudder at 6:30.
Should be a nice time of day right there on the water,
he said, and Olive agreed, although she was distressed about the time. For most of her life, she had eaten supper at 5 o'clock, and that he didn't, apparently, reminded her he was someone about whom she knew nothing, and probably didn't care to either. She had never liked him from the start, and it was foolish to have agreed to dinner. He ordered a vodka and tonic, and she didn't like that.
Water, please, she said firmly to the waitress, who nodded and backed away.
They were sitting kitty-corner to each other at a table for four, so that they could both see the cove with the sailboats and the lobster boats and the buoys bobbing just slightly in the evening's breeze. He seemed much too close to her, his big hairy arm draping down to his drink.
I know Henry was in the nursing home for a long time, Olive.
He looked at her with his very blue eyes.
That had to be hard.
So they talked like that, and it was kind of nice. They both needed someone to talk to, someone to listen, and they did that. They listened, talked, listened more. He never mentioned Harvard. The sun was setting behind the boats as they sat with their decaf coffees. The next week they met for lunch at a small place near the river. Maybe because it was daytime, the spring sunshine full on the grass outside, the parked cars seen through the window reflecting shards of brightness. Maybe the middayness of it made it not as lovely as the time before. Jack seemed tired, his shirt pressed and expensive-looking. Olive felt big and baggy inside her long vest that she had made from an old set of curtains.
"Did your wife sew?" she asked.
"Sew?"
as though he didn't know what the word meant.
"Sew? Make things from cloth?"
"Oh, no."
But when she said that she and Henry had built their house themselves, he said he'd like to see it.
"Fine," she said. "Follow along behind."
She watched in the rearview mirror as his red car moved along behind hers. He parked so poorly, he almost ruined a young birch tree. She heard his steps behind her on the steep walkway. She felt like a whale, imagining her large back from his eyes.
"It's nice, Olive," he said, ducking his head, although there was plenty of room for him to stand up straight.
She showed him the bump-out room, where you could lie and see the side garden through all the glass. She showed him the library, built the year before Henry's stroke, with its cathedral ceiling and skylights. He looked at the books, and she wanted to say,
"Stop that,"
as though he were reading her diary.
"He's like a child," she told Bunny. "He touches everything. Honest to God, he picked up my wooden seagull, turned it around, put it back in the wrong place, then picked up the clay vase Christopher gave us one year and turned that over. What was he looking for? A price?"
Bunny said,
"I think you're being a little hard on him, Olive."
So she didn't talk to Bunny about him anymore. She didn't tell Bunny how they had supper again the next week, how he kissed her on her cheek when she said good night, how they went to Portland to go to a concert, and that night he lightly kissed her mouth. No, these were not things to be spoken of. It was nobody's business, and certainly nobody's business that she lay awake at the age of 74 and thought about his arms around her, pictured what she had not pictured or done in years. At the same time, in her head, she criticized him. He's afraid to be alone, she thought. He's weak. Men were. Probably wants somebody to cook his meals, pick up after him, in which case he was barking up the wrong tree. He spoke of his mother with such frequency and in such glowing terms. Something had to be wrong there. If he wanted a mother, he'd better go looking elsewhere. For 5 days it rained, harsh and heavy, so much for spring. This rain was cold and autumnal, and even Olive, with her need to walk by the river, saw no point in heading out in the mornings. She was not one to carry an umbrella. She had to wait it out in the car outside Dunkin' Donuts with the dog in the back seat. Hellish days. Jack Kennison didn't call, and she didn't call him. She thought he'd probably found someone else to listen to his sorrows. She pictured him sitting beside some woman at a concert in Portland and thought she could put a bullet right through his head. Once again, she thought about her own death. Let it be quick. She called Christopher in New York.
How are you?
She said, angry because he never called.
Fine, he said. How are you?
Hellish, she answered. How's Anne and the kids?
Christopher had married a woman with two children, and now there was his.
Everyone's still walking.
Still walking,
Chris said.
Crazy, hectic.
She almost hated him then. Her life had once been crazy and hectic, too. You just wait, she thought. Everyone thinks they know everything, and no one knows a damn thing.
How was your date?
What date?
She asked.
With that guy you couldn't stand?
That wasn't a date, for crying out loud.
Okay, but how was it?
Just fine, she said. He's a nitwit, and your father always knew it.
Daddy knew him?
Chris said.
You never told me that.
Not knew him, Olive retorted. Just knew him from afar. Enough to know he was a nitwit.
Theodore's crying,
Christopher said.
I have to go.
And then, like a rainbow, Jack Kennison called.
It's supposed to clear off by tomorrow. Shall we meet on the river path?
Don't see why not, Olive said. 6 o'clock I take off.
In the morning, when she drove into the gravelly lot by the river, Jack Kennison leaned against his red car and nodded, his hands staying in his pockets. He had on a windbreaker she'd not seen before, blue. It matched his eyes. She had to get her walking shoes from the trunk and put them on in front of him, which annoyed her. Her walking shoes had been bought in the men's department right after Henry died. Broad and beige, they still laced up, they still walked. She stood up, her breathing heavy.
Let's go, she said.
I might want to rest on the 1 mile bench. I know you like to keep going.
She looked at him. His wife had died 5 months ago.
I'll rest whenever you want to rest, she said.
The river was to their left, broadening at one point, the small island seen, some of the bushes on it already a bright, bright green.
My ancestors paddled their canoes up this river, Olive said.
Jack didn't answer.
I thought I'd have grandchildren that would paddle up the river, too. But my grandson's growing up in New York City. I guess it's the way of the world. Hurts, though. Have that DNA flung all over like so much dandelion thistle.
Olive had to walk slower to match Jack's ambling stride. It was hard, like not drinking water fast if you were thirsty.
At least you have DNA to get tossed, he said,
his hands still in his pockets.
I won't be having any grandchildren. Or not really.
What do you mean, not really? How can you not really have grandchildren?
It took him a while to answer, as she suspected it would. She glanced at him and thought he did not look his best. Something unpleasant sat on his face, his head thrust forward from his sloping shoulders.
My daughter has chosen to live an alternative lifestyle out in California.
I guess California's still the place for that. Alternative lifestyles.
She lives with a woman, Jack said. She lives with a woman the way others would live with a man.
I see, Olive said.
There in the shade was the first mile marker granite bench.
Want to sit?
Jack sat. She sat. They looked out over the river. An elderly couple walked by holding hands, nodded to them, as though they were a couple too. When the couple was out of earshot, Olive said,
So I take it you don't like that about your daughter.
I don't like it at all,
Jack said.
He raised his chin. Perhaps I'm shallow, he said.
Oh, you're sophisticated, Olive answered, adding, though I guess, in my opinion, that can mean the same thing.
He looked at her, his old eyebrows shooting up.
However, I'm not the least bit sophisticated. I'm essentially a peasant, and I have the strong passions and prejudices of a peasant.
What does that mean?
Jack asked. Olive reached into her pocket, found her sunglasses, put them on. After a while, Jack said,
be honest. If your son told you he wanted to sleep with men, did sleep with men, was in love with a man, lived with him, slept with him, made a home with him, do you think really you wouldn't mind?
I wouldn't mind, Olive retorted. I would love him with all my heart.
You're being sentimental, Jack said. You don't know how you'd feel because you haven't been presented with it.
Olive's cheeks grew warm. There was the prick of perspiration beneath one arm.
I've been presented with plenty.
Like what?
Like the fact that my son married a hellion who moved him to California, then walked out on him.
Statistically, Olive, that happens all the time, 50% of the time.
So what?
It struck her as a stupid, unfeeling response.
And what are the statistics of having a gay child?
She asked. Her feet looked enormous, stuck out there at the end of her legs. She pulled them in under the bench.
It changes. Every study they do says something new. But obviously, 50% of one's offspring do not turn out to be gay.
Maybe she's not gay, said Olive. Maybe she just hates men.
Jack Kennison folded his arms against his blue windbreaker, stared straight ahead.
I'm not sure that's very nice, Olive. I haven't offered a theory on why your son married a hellion.
It took Olive a moment to absorb this.
Ducky, she said. A ducky thing to say.
She stood up and didn't wait to see if he stood too, but she heard him behind her and she slowed enough to walk with him. She was heading back to the car.
I still don't know what you mean by saying you're a peasant. In this country, I don't think it's peasantry. Perhaps you mean you're a cowboy.
She glanced at him, was surprised to see he was smiling at her good-naturedly.
I can see you as a cowboy, he said.
Fine. I'm a cowboy.
A Republican, then?
Jack asked after a moment.
Oh, for God's sake!
Olive stopped walking, looked at him through her sunglasses.
I didn't say moron! You mean because we have a cowboy for a president, or before that an actor who played a cowboy? Let me tell you, that idiot, ex-cocaine addict, was never a cowboy. He can wear all the cowboy hats he wants. He's a spoiled brat to the manner born, and he makes me puke.
She was really riled, and it took her a moment to see that he was looking away, his expression closed off, as though inside his head he had backed away and was just waiting for her to finish.
God, she said finally. You didn't.
Didn't what?
You voted for him.
Jack Kennison looked tired.
You voted for him. You, Mr. Harvard, Mr. Brains, you voted for that stinker.
He gave a small bark of a laugh.
My God, you do have the passions and the prejudices of a peasant.
That's it, said Olive.
She began walking at her pace now. She said over her shoulder,
at least I'm not prejudiced against homosexuals.
No, he called, just white men with money.
Damn right, she thought. She called Bunny, and Bunny, Olive couldn't believe this, actually laughed.
Oh, Olive,
she said,
does it really matter?
Matter that someone voted for a man who is lying to the country? Bunny, for God's sake, this world is a mess.
That's true enough,
Bunny said.
But the world has always been a mess. I think if you enjoy his company, you should just let it go.
I don't enjoy his company," Olive said, and hung up. She'd never realized Bunny was an idiot, but there you were. It was terrible, though, when you couldn't tell people things. Olive felt this keenly as the days went by. She called Christopher.
"He's a Republican," she said.
"Well, that's gross,"
Christopher answered. Then,
"I thought you were calling to see how your grandson is."
"Of course I wonder how he is. I wish you'd call me to tell me how he is."
Where and how exactly this rupture with her son had taken place, Olive couldn't have said.
"I do call you Mom."
A long pause.
But what?
"Well, it's a little hard to converse with you."
"I see. Everything is my fault."
"No, everything is someone else's fault. That's my point."
It had to be her son's therapist who was responsible for all this. Who would ever have expected this? She said into the phone,
"Not I," said the little red hen.
"What?"
She hung up. 2 weeks passed by. She walked along the river earlier than 6 so she wouldn't bump into Jack, and because she woke after just a few hours' sleep. The spring was gorgeous and seemed an assault. Star flowers popped through the pine needles. Clusters of purple violets were there by the granite seat. She passed the elderly couple who were holding hands again. After that, she stopped her walking. For a few days, she stayed in bed, which, to her memory, she had never done before. She was not a liar downer. Christopher didn't call. Bunny didn't call. Jack Kennison didn't call. One night, she woke at midnight. She turned on her computer and typed in Jack's email address, which she had gotten back when they were having lunch and going into Portland for concerts.
"Does your daughter hate you?"
she wrote. In the morning was the simple yes. She waited 2 days. Then she wrote,
"My son hates me, too."
An hour later came the response,
"Does it kill you?" "It kills me that my daughter hates me. But I know it's my fault."
She wrote immediately,
"It kills me, like the devil. And it must be my fault, too, though I don't understand it. I don't remember things the way he seems to remember them. He sees a psychiatrist named Arthur, and I think Arthur has done this."
She paused a long time, clicked on send, then immediately wrote, "P.S.
But it has to be my fault, too. Henry said I never apologized for anything, ever, and maybe he was right."
She clicked on send. Then she wrote,
"P.S. again. He was right."
There was no reply to this, and she felt like a schoolgirl whose crush had walked off with a different girl. In fact, Jack probably did have a different girl or woman. Old woman. Plenty of them around. Republicans, too. She lay on the bed in the little bump-out room and listened to the transistor radio she held to her ear. Then she got up and went outside, taking the dog for a walk on a leash, because if he was loose, he'd eat one of the Moody's cats. This had happened before. When she came back, the sun was just past its peak, and it was a bad time of day for her. It'd be better when it got dark. How she had loved the long evenings of spring when she was young, and all of life stretched before her. She was looking through the cupboard for a milk bone for the dog when she heard her phone message machine beep. It was ludicrous how hopeful she was that Bunny or Chris had called. Jack Kennison's voice said,
"Olive, could you come over?"
She brushed her teeth, left the dog in his pen. His shiny red car was in his small driveway. When she knocked on the door, there was no answer. She pushed the door open. "Hello?"
"Hello, Olive. I'm back here. I'm lying down. I'll be right there."
"No," she sang out. "Stay put. I'll come find you."
She found him on the bed in the downstairs guest room. He was lying on his back, one hand beneath his head.
"I'm glad you came over," he said.
"Are you feeling poorly again?"
He smiled that tiny smile.
Only soul poor. The body bangs on.
She nodded. He moved his legs aside.
Come, he said, patting the bed. Sit down. I may be a rich Republican, though I'm not that rich, in case you were secretly hoping. Anyway.
He sighed and shook his head, the sunlight from the windows catching his eyes, making them very blue.
Anyway, Olive, you can tell me anything. That you beat your son black and blue, and I won't hold it against you. I don't think I will. I've beaten my daughter emotionally. I didn't speak to her for 2 years. Can you imagine such a thing?
I did hit my son, Olive said. Sometimes when he was little. Not just spanked, hit.
Jack Kennison nodded one nod. She stepped into the room, put her handbag on the floor. He didn't sit up, just stayed there, lying on the bed, an old man, his stomach bulging like a sack of sunflower seeds. His blue eyes watched her as she walked to him, and the room was filled with the quietness of afternoon sunlight. It fell through the window, across the rocking chair, hit broadside the wallpaper with its brightness. The mahogany bed knobs shone. Through the curved-out window was the blue of the sky, the bayberry bush, the stone wall. The silence of this sunshine, of the world, seemed to fold over Olive with a shiver of ghastliness as she stood feeling the sun on her bare wrist. She watched him, looked away, looked at him again. To sit down beside him would be to close her eyes to the gaping loneliness of this sunlit world.
God, I'm scared,
he said quietly. She almost said,
oh, stop. I hate scared people.
She would have said that to Henry, to just about anyone, maybe because she hated the scared part of herself. This was just a fleeting thought. There was a contest within her, revulsion and tentative desire. It was the sudden memory of Jane Holton in the waiting room that caused Olive to walk to the bed, the freedom of that ordinary banter, because Jack, in the doctor's office, had needed her, had given her a place in the world. His blue eyes were watching her now. She saw in them the vulnerability, the invitation, the fear. As she sat down quietly, placed her open hand on his chest, felt the thump-thump of his heart, which would someday stop, as all hearts do. But there was no someday now. There was only the silence of this sunny room. They were here, and her body, old, big, sagging, felt straight-out desire for his. That she had not loved Henry this way for many years before he died saddened her enough to make her close her eyes. What young people didn't know, she thought, lying down beside this man, his hand on her shoulder, her arm. Oh, what young people did not know. They did not know that lumpy, aged, and wrinkled bodies were as needy as their own young, firm ones, that love was not to be tossed away carelessly as if it were a tart on a platter with others that got passed around again. No, if love was available, one chose it or didn't choose it, and if her platter had been full with the goodness of Henry and she had found it burdensome, had flicked it off crumbs at a time, it was because she had not known what one should know, that day after day was unconsciously squandered. And so, if this man next to her now was not a man she would have chosen before this time, what did it matter? He most likely wouldn't have chosen her either. But here they were, and Olive pictured two slices of Swiss cheese pressed together, such holes they brought to this union. What pieces life took out of you. Her eyes were closed, and throughout her tired self swept waves of gratitude and regret. She pictured the sunny room, the sun-washed wall, the bayberry outside. It baffled her, the world. She did not want to leave it yet. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Olive Kittredge, a novel in stories, by Elizabeth Strout. Copyright 2008 by Elizabeth Strout. Read by Sandra Burr. Directed by Laura Grafton. Engineered by Matthew Kristoloff. Performance copyright 2008 by Brilliance Audio. Recorded by arrangement with Random House, an imprint of Random House Publishing Group, a division of Random House Incorporated. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, Post Office Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.